This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. You're listening to Afternoons with Helen Farmer. It's all about living your best life.
On Dubai Eye 103.8.
I'm Helen Farmer. Fantastic to have you with us on the Afternoons with Helen Farmer podcast. A real health focus today, both physical and mental. And one of the most common questions I'm hearing around at the moment is, have you had COVID? I haven't. Why not? Everyone trying to get to the bottom of why they haven't contracted it. And there have been a number of theories floating around the internet, so we decided to get to the root of the matter, bringing in the doctors, explaining exactly why some people are protected. Plus, a live clinic, Dr. Rizwan joining us, consultant urology surgeon, was on hand to talk about bladder incontinence. It's an issue that affects a surprising number of people. So what are the symptoms? Who is affected? And what can be done? Plus, women's physio Laura Barrett joining us live on the line. And do you experience pretty privilege, getting freebies, special treatment because of the way you look? We were speaking to a TikToker who's really gone viral talking about this topic, and Dr. Thuraya, clinical psychologist, unpicking why society responds positively and sometimes negatively to the attractive among us.
Healthy Habits
on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Have you had COVID? Why haven't I had COVID yet is the question I'm hearing time and time again. And there are many a theory floating around the internet, from blood type to smoking. And joining us now is Dr. Rahul Goyal. He is the Senior Vice President of Clinical Engagement and Adoption and Consultant Family Medicine, St. Malathi and MediClinic as well. Doctor, thank you so much for being with us. So have you had COVID?
Hey, Helen. Thanks. Thankfully not. Probably one of the few last men standing.
Well, me too, to my knowledge, which we're going to be exploring as well. And, you know, truth be told, I've been in work every single day since the pandemic started. I've been careful, you know, in a kind of normal, moderate way. I certainly haven't locked myself away. I've got two kids in school. I've got a husband who's out and about as well. And I've been speaking to many friends and colleagues, and that seems to be the hot topic right now. You know, I haven't had COVID, but I don't really understand why I haven't. So let's chat through some of the theories that we have heard, whether that is in person or, yes, the dreaded internet as well. Nicotine. People saying I'm a smoker, so I'm not affected, which seems pretty counterintuitive to me. What does the data say, Dr. Rahul?
I think anything that we say at the moment is all going to be a hypothesis,
of course,
and a theory, not evidence-based, obviously. There isn't any correlation between being a smoker and not getting COVID. And as you alluded on, in the contrary, a healthy lifestyle would afford you a better immunity and protection than not. So anything related to smoking or not the best lifestyle choice, if I would say, would be more of a coincidence than a theory.
Well, Ali is saying, I've had COVID twice and almost everyone in my home has, just flu. We're all super fit. My husband smokes shisha daily and isn't healthy, didn't isolate, no COVID. I'm not into conspiracies, but find it quite amazing. We're putting it down to coincidence. Yeah. What about someone saying they've got a specific blood type? Because early in the pandemic, some reports suggested that people with A-type blood were more susceptible to COVID, while those with O-type blood, that's me, were less so. Why would that stack up, or does it fall apart?
Yes, I remember reading that story as well. And there were all sorts of theories going on. One of them was the blood type. Another one was people who've had a BCG vaccine as a child are protected naturally. I think most of the theories got debunked because a number of people who had blood A or O got infected in a similar sort of fashion. So those are more of tales that started right at the start of the pandemic when we don't know how it's going to pan out. Mm-hmm. I think if I was a betting man, I would say more people have had COVID than not at the moment in a community. So most of those theories got debunked right at that, probably about 3 or 4 months into COVID. There isn't a set pattern. There isn't a recognized protective factor apart from, like I said, a healthy lifestyle, moderation in exercise, diet, not smoking rather than smoking.
A doctor, I like it. We're not prescribing smoking on the show this afternoon. What about people's claim that they've got superhuman immunity, that they are just, you know, they're basically Iron Man without the suit? There's something innate in them, their blood, their makeup, their immune system, that means COVID just bounces off them. Do some people have incredibly good immunity that would perhaps protect them?
I think that's probably true, because even prior to COVID, when the flu season used to hit us, I mean, one of the reasons why I always get my flu jab every year, like clockwork, is because I was one of the first few ones to catch the common cold working in a surgery in the UK or wherever. And I had colleagues who would never, ever get sick. So a person-specific makeup of immunity is probably true. There isn't any data to suggest one particular type is linked. It could be genetic, it could be immunity, the way we produce immunity, coincidence or luck. It could be a lot of factors. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I do feel some people are better off against getting infections than others, but we don't know why yet.
There was also a theory about taking a specific antidepressant. It was an observational study, but patients taking selective serotonin retake inhibitors, the SSRIs, were 8% less likely to die from COVID-19. Again, many of this being debunked. We've got Dr. Rahul Goyal joining us from Malafi and Mediclinic this afternoon. Up next, is it possible to have had COVID and not realise it? And is it useful to have our antibodies tested?
Healthy Habits.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Have you had COVID? Tell us about your experiences. And if you haven't, why you think that might be. A message here for you, Dr. Rahul Goyal, Senior Vice President at Malafi and Family Medicine Consultant as well at Mediclinic, saying, in my home, my partner and I got the virus. I'm the healthy one, exercise every day, eat healthy, don't smoke. My partner, who is the opposite, tested positive. And if he didn't get tested, he wouldn't have known he had it. So here's my question to you, Doctor. As I said earlier, I've been in work every day. I've been cautious, but not, you know, I'm not disinfecting my groceries anymore. I'm not wearing gloves. I'm masked, of course, and social distancing. But I wouldn't say I've been, you know, doing anything more than the general population. And yet I have it. But is it possible that people listening today who say they haven't had COVID may have actually contracted it and not realised it?
That's quite true. Asymptomatic COVID is a known phenomenon, especially quite a lot in communities who are being tested regularly. So I know the UAE, the testing regimes are quite strict and relevant, especially in the school children. We've noticed a lot of asymptomatic carriers, same as in the community. Now, it would come up positive on a PCR test. The likelihood of it coming positive on a PCR test is close to 80%. So it would be those thin end of the wedge of 20% in a community where testing is happening quite stringently, who would probably be asymptomatic carriers and not being positive on a test. Mm. Yeah.
It's interesting. So here's my question to you then. Is it useful to have our antibodies tested? I had mine done about a year ago. And there's no delicate way of saying this. They were absolutely in the toilet. what kind of information can that reveal? And is it actually useful for acting upon?
So this was a question that kept getting asked a lot in the middle of the year, last year. Research, the WHO, and most of the regulatory bodies and the scientific community differ against it. They say that checking antibodies does not allow us to make a decision on whether a person needs to get vaccinated or their risk of contracting COVID. What I would say, though, is that if you have a health condition that predisposes you to having a complicated COVID, like diabetes, high blood pressure, all the recognized health issues, or if you are a cancer patient on treatment which reduces your immunity with medications, as we call them, immunosuppressive medications, then your chance of contracting COVID are higher and your chance of contracting COVID with complications are higher. Mm-hmm. So you need to protect yourself. Your loved ones should understand that your protection needs are different from theirs, extra precautions, and any any doubt of you getting COVID should be taken up with your physician, so that they'll have a low threshold of testing and acting upon.
So, Dr. Hill, are we really concluding here that if anyone hasn't caught COVID, it's probably because they've been vaccinated and probably because they've been quite lucky as well?
I would say a mixture of being lucky, being careful, vaccinated, careful, and coincidence, yes. And probably those 20% of people who might not get tested positive on a PCR if you have a low dose of COVID, not enough for the tests to amplify it in the test results. So, yeah, a combination of all that could lead to.
Really interesting. Good to go have a few conspiracy theories debunked. and a worthwhile reminder that we speak to proper doctors, not Dr. Google. Dr. Hill, thank you so much for your time today. Please continue to stay positive, test negative. And the same to everyone listening today.
Healthy Habits
on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Welcome to your live clinic. We're in conversation with Dr. Rizwan Hamid from King's College Hospital, Dubai. He's a consultant urological surgeon. He's been at the University College Hospitals and the London Spinal Injuries Unit in Stanmore in the UK as well. Here to talk about overactive bladders, urinary incontinence, something that I can guarantee you know someone in your life that suffers from it, even if they don't talk about it. Dr. Rizwan, how are you this afternoon?
Helen, thank you. I'm very well.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you with us. And I feel that topics like this are things that really need to get a little bit more airtime, because as soon as I tell someone we're talking about incontinence, it's incredible how many messages I get. And a lot of them are saying, please don't mention my name. Curious to get your doctor's advice on this. And it seems to be something that an awful lot of people suffer from in silence. But how common are these topics, these conditions, overactive bladder, urinary incontinence? Do we have any numbers?
Thank you, Helen. You're absolutely right. I think it's still a taboo that we don't like talking about pelvic floor function, especially urinary incontinence. Actually, one in six of us do suffer from urinary incontinence. And as we age, both men and women, the problem worsens. To start off, it's only 2%, but once we are in past our 60s, then it can go up to almost 20%.
Oh, wow. Okay. So there is a huge, you know, part of the population that might get this as part of aging, but there are other causes, and that can be through childbirth being one, lifestyle factors, and all sorts of different things we're going to be touching on. Can you tell us about the symptoms? And let's start with the overactive bladder. What are some of the things you would look for as a urologist if someone comes into clinic complaining of certain issues?
So the symptoms of overactive bladder are essentially four. One is increased frequency of maturation during the daytime. And normally, if you go beyond 7 times a day, that is urinary frequency, which is increased. Nocturia means getting up at night. Now, if you're less than 65 years of age, then you should not be getting up at night even once. If I might add, no matter what drinks you had during the daytime. And then the other main symptom is the urgency, that is, one is not being able to hold on. If you've got to go, you have got to go. And then a proportion of the patients will develop urinary incontinence. That is, if you try to hold on for too long, before you reach the toilet, one wets him or herself.
What about stress incontinence, doctor? Can you explain what that is?
Yes. So the end result is urinary incontinence, i.e. one leaks urine. But there are two types of incontinence. One is stress, that is any increase in the abdominal pressure, exercising, jogging, running, lifting something up. Once somebody loses urine, that is known as stress incontinence, which is different to urge incontinence. That is, if one tries to hold on to the urine and leaks before reaching the toilet. So these are two main types of incontinences.
Healthy Habits
on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
The doctor is in the house, Dr. Rizwan Hamid from King's College Hospital, Dubai, joining us this afternoon. He's a consultant urological surgeon, and we're talking about overactive bladder, urinary incontinence, and many of you getting in touch with your questions and concerns on 4001. Dr. Rizwan with us this afternoon. We're going to get through as many questions as we can, if you don't mind, sir. I was going to ask if you had your coffee, but it's a diuretic, so maybe you have, maybe you haven't. Jay got in touch earlier saying, I'm 50, but I've always had a weak bladder. I don't even drink a lot of liquids during the day. Are some people just born with weak bladders? I have no idea, Dr. Rizwan. What do you think?
Jay, thanks for the question. Yes, some people are born with a weak bladder. And one of the telltale signs is that probably they are bedwetting a little bit later in life. So you are bedwetting in your sometime up until your teens. Okay. But that is not always the case. And some people develop as they grow through their 20s and 30s. And like I've taken this from one of the supermarket slogans is that every little helps. And my slogan is every little is not helping. Mm-hmm. As you grow older, have children, put on some weight, maybe smoking, not exercising, fluids. So then every little is not helping. And then this problem comes to light.
I think it's much like, I don't know how to compare it, but I think if you have, you know, a good system, so to speak, you don't realise perhaps the suffering that the people go through. It's a bit like eyesight. If you've got good eyesight, you take it for granted. If, you know, if you don't need to think about going to the toilet urgently, it's something that you don't even think about. But as we said earlier, one in six people suffering from some form of incontinence. And we very much are here to shine a light on that today and help you out. Great message come in on 4001 for you, doctor, saying, if bladder increased frequency might be related to an existing uterine fibroid pressing against the bladder, should I see my gynecologist or urologist? Great question in terms of where to start. What do you think?
Yes, it's a great question. I think if there's an obvious cause, like a uterine fibroid, urinary tract infection, or bladder prolapse, then that needs to be sorted first before you can get on and treatment for the overactive bladder symptoms. So I think it's always wise to see the gynecologist to see if the fibroids are pressing on the bladder, and they need to be sorted before you want treatment for the overactive bladder.
We've had questions coming in about choosing to give birth in different ways as well. I wonder if you can help with that, Doctor. No Name saying, I've had one baby already, a natural birth, and suffer from urge incontinence issues. We're trying for a second and thinking about an elective C-section. I do pelvic floor already. I'm on medication for urge incontinence when not pregnant. I've seen urologists, tried bladder training. Even on medication, I go to the toilet frequently. And when I need to go, I need to go, which is in capitals. The idea of an elective C-section being major surgery puts me off, but I also don't want to end up with worse incontinence issues if I have a vaginal birth. Would really appreciate your doctor's insights. Thank you for that.
Thank you for the great question. This is one of the big debated points and controversies in the pelvic floor surgery, that whether doing an elective C-section decreases the risk of incontinence. Certainly, there is some evidence that it will decrease for stress-related incontinence. For the urge-related, which you have got, there isn't that much evidence that going for C-section will decrease the bladder becoming more urgent. So I think you'll have to treat the symptoms that come along and then take things from there.
Dr. Rosen joining us this afternoon. We're going to be talking about treatment next. KW says, I've heard bladder Botox is a thing. Is it available here? Is there anything we can't Botox these days? Dr. Rosen will explain if that's something you can actually try. And Tony is saying he's 66, suffers from urinary urgency. Once I head the loo to pee, I can hardly hold it until I get there. What can I do to stop this? So we're here for you, young and old, male and female, as we discuss this issue here on Dubai i103.8.
Healthy Habits.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Joining us live on Microsoft Teams is Dr. Rizwan Hamid from King's College Hospital, Dubai, where he's a consultant urological surgeon. And we're talking about overactive bladders, urinary incontinence. And we've got men, women, people of all ages joining this conversation and really reaching out for a bit of advice. And that's absolutely fine and it's absolutely free. Dr. Rizwan, we've had many messages coming in wanting to know about treatment, but also about where to start, to be honest. Tony's been in touch saying, hi, I'm 66, suffer from urinary urgency. Once I'm heading to the loo to pee, I can hardly hold it until I get there. What can I do to stop this? Thank you. Any advice for Tony and any other men suffering from a similar problem?
Yes. Thank you, Helen. For Tony, the advice is, Tony, it is possible that your urinary urgency is on the back of what we call as voiding symptoms in men. So the frequency, urgency, and getting up at night might be because you're not emptying your bladder. You're past 65 years of age. If I say your prostate is getting bigger, so what you need to do is to see a urologist. He'll just run baseline investigations to make sure that your prostate is not obstructing. And if that is not, then you can have the treatment for urgency, like with fluid management medications and going on to the Botox. But for you and all men, it is important to see a urologist to rule out obstruction before you start treatment for overactive bladder.
And staying with that, a message here, anonymous, saying, I'm 59 and have an enlarged prostate. What is the best way to manage this? I'm otherwise very healthy and have no issue about waking up at night. And does the removal of the prostate affect people?
Yes, the removal of prostate does affect people. Prostate is an accessory sexual gland. So once ejaculates, it provides about a third of the semen volume. So operation is not an answer. You need to see a urologist. Most often, it will be medications, lifestyle alterations, and actually 9 out of 10 men now do not need an operation. They just need, you need to start early, get investigated, and with lifestyle alteration and medications, I think you should be perfectly all right, but you need to seek advice as soon as possible.
Let's talk treatment, because we've had a message here from KW on 4001 saying, I've heard bladder Botox is a thing. Is it available here? I mean, it's Botox, it's Dubai. I'm guessing it's available here. Was there anything we will not Botox? I don't think so. Armpits, foreheads, bladders? Dr. Rizwan, what is this about?
Helen, KW, you're absolutely right. We are Botoxing everything. But I must say, this is a cliche now, but Botox has revolutionized the treatment of lots of areas in medicine, and bladder is no exception. Previously, if the medications and lifestyle alterations do not help, then you need to either leave it there or go on to have major surgery. But Botox is part of the treatments we call as minimally invasive therapies, which are there to help the overactive bladder, which is what we call it as resistant to medication. So it is there. We do it. It's a very good treatment. But one has to point out that like Botox anywhere else, the effects are not permanent. Mm-hmm. They will last somewhere between 6 to 9 months, but it's minimal invasive. It is available and a good treatment. But Helen, I would like to add at the same time that along with Botox, there is something known as neuromodulation, which is also a very good treatment for overactive bladder. So my advice would be that if you've got symptoms which are resistant to medications and lifestyle alterations, then you should go and see somebody who will provide an array of treatments. Like we say, one size does not fit all. So you need to see somebody who will give you all the options, pros and cons. And like all of us have got different preferences, so you can pick the choice which suits.
Dr. Rizwan, you mentioned that lifestyle alterations. What kind of changes would you like to advise anyone out there really to maintain a healthy bladder, but especially anyone who might be suffering from any kind of incontinence?
Well, starting from fluid and dietary intake, make sure that 50% of the intake is water. I always say it's not my job to tell anybody what to drink. People like drinking coffee, other beverages. So 50% of the intake should be water. Stop smoking, exercise regularly, empty the bladder regularly, and try to make sure that you've got a healthy, balanced lifestyle. And that should be the starting point, and obviously lose weight. So reduce caffeine, but you do not eliminate it. Balance it along with the other fluid intake. So those will be the classical lifestyle changes.
Coming to the text line, Kath has been in touch saying, just want to share my experience. This has been a big problem for me post-menopause, and I never had kids to blame. What I found that's helped is never leave home or work without a final pee, avoid mixing water and caffeine, and most importantly, try estrogen. The incontinence I had was linked to changes in the vagina and the bladder, not pelvic floor weakness. It can be helped. Can you talk about that hormone aspect? Kath there recommending estrogen. What role does that play, doctor?
Yes. So what happens is that once one goes past menopause, then the level of estrogens drop. And instead of having systemic estrogens, vaginal estrogens increase the estrogen in the vaginal area, which increases the blood flow, decreases the rate of infections, because generally a bacteria is there known as lactobacillus, and estrogens help convert it to lactic acid, which makes the environment unfriendly for bacterial growth. It increases the lubrication, so it helps all aspects of lower urinary tract function, and also it helps with the sexual side of things also.
There you go. Kath, thank you for sharing your story there. And a final question, no name on this one for you, Dr. Rizwan, saying, I'm 27 now, but since school, I've wet myself if I giggle too hard, also sneezing. Recently, I've been needing to wee more often. It's not diabetes related. I've had a test. I have endometriosis too, so I've put it down to that. But recently, been having accidents more often. I've had to start wearing special underwear. I do Kegel exercises already. What should I do next? Thank you for that message and putting that into the world for Dr. Rizwan to answer. What would you say to this listener?
Yeah, thank you. This is known as giggle incontinence. It is a, in a way, diagnosis in itself. If you haven't had any kids, then it has to be either a weak or a dysfunctional pelvic floor. The start off is pelvic floor exercises, lose weight, and then have a regime of formal training under physiotherapy, which, Helen, you said the next speaker is going to talk about. Like anything else in medicine, we don't use two terms, always or never, but doing these simple steps 95 out of 100 times, it will settle over time. In a very small proportion of patients, you might need to have surgery, but that needs to be very carefully thought through.
Okay. Dr. Risen, thank you for being with us this afternoon. Some really no-nonsense advice, some really useful insights, and thank you to everyone for being in touch. Dr. Risen can be found if you are looking to have some specialist treatment at King's College Hospital. He is there as a consultant urological surgeon. Dr. Risen Hamid, thank you so much for your time. Really, really appreciate it.
Healthy Habits.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
I've got to be honest, we've been a little bit overwhelmed with messages over the course of the afternoon as we discuss urinary incontinence, overactive bladder. And joining us now, we have got women's physio at Genesis, Laura Barrett, who can explain a little bit about the role that physio can have. Laura, how are you?
I'm good, thank you, Helen. How are you?
I'm really well. As I said, I've been surprised by the number of messages we've had. Dr. Rizwan saying earlier that one in six people suffering from this, men and women and all ages as well. But we have seen some kind of patterns emerging in terms of age, but also following childbirth as well. And I just wondered, what are some of the conditions that you're treating and have treated historically when it comes to incontinence?
So I'm a women's health physio, but I specialise in postnatal care. So most of the women I'm seeing are having problems with their bladder after childbirth. So they may be experiencing stress incontinence, which is where you have the loss of urine with the raised intra-abdominal pressure, such as laughing, coughing, sneezing. Sometimes they have urge incontinence, which is where the bladder muscles become overactive and therefore they're leaking urine. And signs of prolapse as well. So when the bladder actually prolapses down into the vagina.
And it must be heartbreaking to be, you know, you've welcomed a baby and, you know, you feel like you should be absolutely on top of the world, but you're dealing with this whole other health condition that you perhaps never could have predicted or no one really talks about, which is why I'm glad we are shining something of a spotlight on it today. Laura, I wanted to ask you, when do people come to see you? At what point? Are they have tried to deal with it at home? They've been doing their Kegels. They've consulted Dr. Google. Are people quite desperate by the time they walk through your door?
Yes, absolutely. Unfortunately, now we know that about 45% of women after childbirth will experience some form of incontinence. And the really sad thing is only about a third of these women are comfortable to come forward, speak to their friends, speak to their partners, speak to doctors. So they, like you say, the first thing they do is they go online and start looking at pelvic floor exercises, Kegel exercises. Now, the problem here is that sometimes, and actually more often than not, there's some pelvic floor tightness that is involved. And if you start to strengthen your pelvic floor before it's been assessed properly, you can actually make it worse if you have this pelvic floor tightness. So it's really important that when women have any sign of incontinence, they come to see a physio very early on. Mm-hmm. So I can see people. We normally recommend they have their 6-week check, but if they are suffering with incontinence before then I'm happy to see them before. I don't want them to wait till the 6-week mark if they're really struggling. Because obviously, like you say, the psychological impact, the emotional impact is devastating.
Can you explain and perhaps demystify what might happen when it comes to coming to see you? Now, I have been to see a women's health specialist after I gave birth for exactly that kind of peace of mind. Is everything okay? And thankfully, everything was. But I don't know how to put this. Let's just say I wasn't prepared to be taking off my leggings. Is that fair to say? It's a pretty thorough examination.
Yes, it really is. We have to look at the whole of you. So we would start by looking at your movement and your posture, how you're functioning. And then we would move on to the pelvic floor. And to really get a good idea of how your pelvic floor is working and to check if you have any of this tightness, we would need to do an internal pelvic floor examination. It's not painful. It only takes 5 or 10 minutes, but it's really the only way that we can check the muscle, see how strong it is, see how well you are activating it. Because this is the other problem, that lots of women don't know how to activate the muscle correctly. So they've been trying really hard at home, but actually they've been working the wrong muscles. So you don't want to be wasting your time. So we can teach you how to do it properly. And then we have a baseline measure of how your pelvic floor is at that precise moment. And we can then send you away with the right exercises or the right relaxation techniques and then we can reassess again in the future.
I think for a lot of women, there is a certain amount of shame and stigma attached to this. It's still something of a taboo. And many people just hope that it's going to get better in time. And unfortunately, that's the opposite of the reality. Can you explain what might happen if these issues aren't addressed? And that can be to do with incontinence, you know, sexual function and just day-to-day quality of life.
Yeah, absolutely. So many women go on and suffer in silence. And this is what we're trying to say to everybody, that these symptoms are so common, but they're not normal. So you definitely need to have treatment. And what we find is that just generally with the aging process, and then definitely when we hit menopause, which changes the collagen mix in our bodies, that symptoms can get worse. So if you have symptoms of incontinence after a pregnancy, it can worsen in the second pregnancy, or they can worsen as you start to hit the menopause. So it's really vital. They are treatable. And there's lots of things we can do with physiotherapy. We can do exercises. We can do stretches. We do bladder retraining. We do behavioral training. We can really help you. So it's important you seek the right advice, stop the symptoms quickly, and then move on with living your life.
We had a message earlier that came in on 4001, Laura, no name in it, but saying she'd had a vaginal delivery and has been suffering from urge incontinence issues. They're trying for a second and is thinking about an elective C-section. This listener says she's already doing pelvic floor exercises. She's on medication for urge incontinence when not pregnant. She's seen urologists to try bladder training. But even when she's on medication, she goes to the toilet frequently. And when she needs to go, was in capitals, saying the idea of an elective C-section being major surgery puts her off, but also doesn't want to deal with the possibility of the incontinence getting worse if she has a vaginal birth. She was asking Dr. Rizwan's advice, and he was saying it very much depends on urge incontinence versus stress incontinence. What would your take be as a women's physio?
Yeah, I was going to say the same. So urge incontinence tends to be less about the pelvic floor being weak and more about the behaviour around the bladder. Stress incontinence is to do more with the supporting structures and the weakness and tightness around the pelvic floor. Now, we know that some forms of childbirth, if they've had to use forceps, if you've had a prolonged pushing phase, if the baby's big, it can affect stress incontinence. It has less influence on urge incontinence.
So what would your advice be in this situation? I'm not certainly not asking you to give a diagnosis and tell her what to do, but if this was your best friend, what would you advise?
I mean, it's a difficult one. She needs to speak to her obstetrician. I had two elective C-sections, so I'm quite pro C-section. I think you can recover really nicely after a C-section. If she's worried just about the urge incontinence, I don't think a natural delivery would make it worse. Mm-hmm. But it comes down to personal preference and medical discussion with your doctor, really, on how you're going to deliver your babies.
Laura, thank you so much. We've had a question here saying, how do you go and see a women's physio? Do you need a referral? Great question, especially in a place of health insurance as well. Would someone need to go to their GP or urologist in order to get a referral? Could someone make a booking with you direct at Genesis?
Yep, so they could come straight to me at Genesis unless their insurance requires pre-approval and a doctor's letter. But in terms, if their insurance is happy, I'm more than happy for them to self-refer. This normally speeds up the process so they can come and see me as soon as they have a problem.
Laura Barrett, thank you so much. Women's physio at Genesis Clinic. If you want Laura's details, you can message me on 4001. Laura, really, really appreciate your time. Thank you so, so much.
Healthy Habits.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
It is our psychology hour. We're asking, do you benefit from pretty privilege? In a recent article, women revealed that they get free concert tickets, free food, better service because of their good looks, but insist it can also be a curse because they're not taken seriously. Have you experienced this? Do you benefit from it? Dr. Thrya joining us very shortly to explain a bit of psychology behind it and perhaps some potential downfalls as well. Now, one woman has experienced this, has gone viral on TikTok, is Anjola Fogbemi. She is a neuroscience registered nurse and a model from Chicago. So, Anjola, why do you think you have experienced this pretty privilege?
So, I think I've experienced pretty privilege because when I go out, oftentimes people will come up to me, and I think that's the initial attraction is like, oh, who is this lady? I want to speak to her. But I think what keeps people going is that I actually know how to keep up the conversation, and I'm a very good conversationalist. And this is because of the type of jobs I've worked and the type of job I currently work. So I'm a neuroscience nurse and I speak to patients every day. I speak to their families. And so it's just something that has trained me on how to keep a good conversation going and how to get to know people. I also think maybe because it's been the pandemic, some people feel grateful that I'm an essential worker. And so they also are more likely to give me something. And it only mostly happens when I'm alone versus with a group of people and friends, because I think that makes me seem more approachable.
All right, so let's get to it. Tell us some of the things you have received for free because you think of the way you look.
Some of the things I've received because of pretty privilege, I would say I've received quite a few things that range from concert tickets to multiple Uber rides, free surf lessons. So I went to this ice cream shop once when I was in San Diego, and the owner of the ice cream shop offered me swim lessons because I was a solo traveler on that trip.
Red flag. But do you think that people are just generous because you are pretty and attractive?
I think that the generosity and the kindness is more about my personality, but the initial attraction to speak to me is because of how I look.
We're going to be talking to Dr. Thraya about the pitfalls of being pretty. What have you experienced?
I think some of the pitfalls are just general safety issues. So I solo travel quite frequently. And a few months ago, I was in Athens, Greece, and I feel like I stood out more. And because of that, during dinner, I had a solo dinner outside on the patio of a restaurant. And a man who kept making advances towards me wouldn't get the message that I didn't want to speak to him. And he stuck around, waited for me to finish my dinner. And I felt very unsafe. And so I couldn't go to my next location or go back to my hotel by myself because I knew he would follow me. So I had to have the waiter at my restaurant escort me back to my hotel or escort me to a different restaurant. And I felt genuinely scared about walking by myself.
Food for thought indeed. And Jola speaking to us, who has gone viral on TikTok, the hashtag pretty privilege is one to watch right now. Up next, Dr. Thraya, clinical psychologist at the Human Relations Institute and Clinic, talks about why we as society do tend to respond differently to those who are conventionally attractive.
Healthy Habits
on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
We are talking about pretty privilege this afternoon. Is this something you've experienced, benefited from, or just witnessed? Delighted to be joined live on the line by Dr. Thraya, clinical psychologist at the Human Relations Institute and Clinic. Thraya, how are you?
I'm well. How are you, Helen?
I am very well. I find this really interesting because we've had lots of messages on kind of both sides of the fence, really. Not that there's a debate as such, because pretty privilege exists. It's pretty much undeniable. But how do you know as an individual that you might be benefiting from it, do you think?
Well, I think one of the key factors is that you recognize that you're receiving things for free in quite an abundance and without any kind of at least explicit return. So monetary or maybe even trading of services and so on and so forth.
Now, let's go to the text line, 4001. Reginda saying, I remember when I was in Spain with my cousin, she was really confident, long, beautiful hair, very pretty. I'm confident, attractive in my own way, but did find the guys would come up to her and I would just be the cousin. What I found is that she lapped up the attention, enjoyed it, but it never made me feel better or included in the conversation. It was all about her and I found that quite selfish. Ziad said, I don't find many pretty girls with a good sense of humour. If you know of one, Helen, please let me know. LOL, we might know a few. And Joe saying, I find most handsome men boring. Once had a very handsome man ask me to dance in France. He said, come sit with me. I did. He sat with the other girls chatting and ignored me. It was like he was collecting pretty females to sit around him because he could. I find that a big sign of insecurity. Can we kind of zoom out a little bit, Thraya, and talk about why we respond to attractive people as individuals, but also as a society in a certain way?
Of course. So I think the most important psychological concept that we have to consider when we talk about pretty privilege is the halo effect. And that's essentially when we take these general or like the global evaluations of a person, and we allow them to bleed into their character or into our judgments about their qualities and their traits and who they are as individuals. So more often than not, when we see somebody who's attractive, then we start to think, or that has, you know, high status or a lot of money. So we start to think to ourselves, oh, they must be nice. They might be funny. Mm-hmm. They might be interesting. So one global, let's say, evaluation might bleed into who they are. So essentially, when we see an attractive person, and this is when we talk about attraction, we're talking about what we would say in terms of like these societal standards, right? So when we talk about this attractive person, we start to think to ourselves, and this attractive person must be nice, must be friendly, must be extroverted, social, and so on and so forth. So we find them and we kind of rationalize why we look up to them.
So that's interesting. So physically attractive people are more likely then to be seen as possessing these positive personal qualities.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, politicians use it all the time in order for them to get reelected. Actually, one of the most interesting facts about that came out of the U.S. is 17 out of 21 presidents were tall. And height is actually a very interesting, attractive trait that tends to give us this halo effect that because they're taller, they possess all of these great qualities. So imagine 17 out of 21 presidents were elected, and were actually very tall. And there are so many research studies that show, even in the United States and in Europe, they show that people that view taller individuals, and there was actually this amazing study that was done in New York where they brought two people that look pretty much the exact same, but one of them is taller and one of them is not, and the not taller person was actually average height for a male. So when they asked people to describe like what kind of job this person had, the taller person had doctor, lawyer, engineer, CEO, whereas the average person had something like homeless, teacher, something where in their mind they thought it wasn't such a great or powerful position. So it's really interesting. And you look at research studies time and time again. There was really interesting one done in the UK with two different women, one that was deemed attractive, like societally standardized attractive, and one not. And they were struggling with taking their luggage up the escalator, and they saw how quickly the woman who was deemed attractive got help from men rather than the one who wasn't. The one who wasn't, it took anywhere between 2 to 4 minutes, whereas the attractive one was within
seconds.
6 to 30 seconds.
Right.
Yes.
Dr. Thrai is with us until 5 o'clock today as we unpack pretty privilege. Is this something you've experienced or witnessed? And how do you feel about it? We've had a few messages, a few confessions as well. Seema saying, I have to admit, did I get off with a parking ticket once by fluttering my eyelids and chatting nicely? Saved me £35.
Healthy Habits.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Let's get real. We all know that life is far from equal, and the list of evidence of that is endless. One bias that many of us might struggle to accept or care to admit, let alone talk about, is pretty privilege. This topic started trending on TikTok alongside, well, you know, jeans and baked feta pasta and pesto eggs and all that stuff, with the videos tagged hashtag pretty privilege, getting nearly 70 million views. So we're deciding to delve a bit deeper into the subject. So what exactly is pretty privilege? How does it affect you? And does it actually matter? Dr. Thrai, clinical psychologist at Human Relations Institute and Clinic, joining us. And loving your messages on this topic, 4001. If you feel like you've benefited from it, so this is getting special treatment, you know, freebies, maybe beneficial opportunities, or has it been a bit of a curse? Let us know your experiences and how you feel about it on 4001. Dee says, I was out with a woman at the weekend who has pretty privilege, and it's certainly true people are different around her. She's not actually that pretty. She's slim and blonde, dyed in brackets, and her hair, makeup, clothes are well done. But without them, she'd be pretty ordinary. What she does have is bags of confidence and a permanent smile. No name on this one, saying, as a youngster, I was very pretty indeed. And yes, it did make a difference. patients. Men and women were on the whole really nice to me. I had doors open for me, got favourable treatment, but I didn't realise. People would turn their heads in the street occasionally, and I always had lots of male attention. Now I've got three kids and I'm fat in my very late 30s and realise what it's like on the other side and just how privileged I was. And Leonie's saying, I've got a friend who was and still is very pretty. But I tend to think of it as being more of a curse for her. She's had a lot of bother with men. It affects who she trusts. And I think she's anxious at the same time about losing her looks. I think it's better to be average. What do you think? Let us know on 4001. Dr. Thryer, let's have a chat about that flip side. You're talking earlier about the halo effect, that we see someone attractive, or, you know, and I'm talking men and women. You mentioned the height there, seeing people being paid more, being promoted if they're taller, you know, more positive perceptions about traits and abilities. We've also seen complaints, especially on this TikTok, about pretty women in particular feeling judged, excluded, and not taken seriously because of how they look. And also false impressions, people assuming that they're vain or are a threat to others. What have you heard in psychological circles, but also, you know, patients that have come into clinic?
Well, I think pretty much all of the things that you had just mentioned, Helen, are definitely accurate, especially things about being judged easily or not thinking that they can carry a conversation or they have anything interesting or smart to say. But I think one of the most significant downsides for pretty privilege is this idea that most people have very high expectations of attractive people. So when they fail to live up to those expectations, they're actually punished a lot more harshly than those that are not as, you know, societally attractive. So when you have higher expectations of the more attractive individuals, you put them on this pedestal. And so you see this with a lot of celebrities and politicians when they are literally doing things that any human would fall, you know, or fall victim to. What ends up happening is that we judge them and we talk about them. So this is the opposite of the halo effect. This is now the horn effect, so, which is basically kind of like the devil horns, right? And so one bad thing happens and it's like, oh my God, this person's a disaster. So there's, so yes, the downside is equally for the judgment of, like, they're not smart, they're not interesting, they're just, they're very vain and superficial and so on and so forth. But also they get judged a lot more harshly than individuals who don't fall under that category.
Olivia Paulson on social media says she's been abused by other women simply for being hot. A TikToker called Ali says there are, in her words, numerous perils that come with being pretty. She claims it can be hard dating and making genuine female friendships when women are intimidated by beauty. And I kind of get it. I think I've probably been there being like, oh, but she's really stuck up and, you know, that. Yeah, I'm wondering if you can unlearn pretty privilege as perhaps someone who's more at the normal end. Why do you think some of us are quite suspicious of good-looking people? Is it jealousy?
I think, I don't know if it's jealousy. I think a bit of it is a feeling of unfairness. So the idea behind those who are privy to pretty privilege, what ends up happening is that they start to be treated unfairly. So they have more advantages than those that don't. And so it's not a matter of jealousy, but there's this discrepancy between having, especially for people who like work very hard and they're trying to get to move forward in life. And then you have somebody pretty that kind of walks in and is just given everything on a silver platter. So it's not so much of jealousy as this like unfairness of treatment and this idea of we would hope that the world is kind of functions on a fair level. So when we see that it doesn't, which in most cases it doesn't, unfortunately, we start to have negative feelings towards that. And we need to place that somewhere. We put it on the person.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of get it. I really do, in the sense that it's surely natural to want to be around attractive people just for, you know, the viewing pleasures, you know, should we say, and that could be following them on Instagram or, you know, wanting to interact with them. I know we shouldn't say that, but I feel like it's, some people are naturally magnetic, but it does sometimes come back to confidence, which was a point earlier. A listener said that, you know, their sister, I think, is attractive, but it's more to do with that bags of confidence. What would you say that? What do you think makes someone magnetic?
Well, actually, you know, Helen, in the eyes of beauty, when we do so much research on beauty and attraction, men and women will find confidence to be far more attractive than actual physical appearance, which is very interesting because, and this is where the whole idea of beauty is in the eye of the beholder comes in. You see many people, when you see them together, you're just like, how did this happen? And this is in your opinion, right? From your perspective.
That's but one of my favorite games. How did they get together?
Right.
What's going on?
So, like, how did this work? So this how did that work is basically this idea of confidence. And the confidence is extremely attractive because once you break that initial barrier, then the personality kicks in. And that's essentially what the pretty privilege has over people who don't fall under that category is that they know they don't have to wait to kind of prove, if you will, themselves initially, but they need to prove themselves afterwards. Mm-hmm. Whereas the people who don't fall into pretty privilege, they have to kind of, they need to wait to cross the barrier for people to actually approach them or for them to approach somebody and break that initial barrier for people to see who they truly are. Because even with pretty privilege, it's a very superficial thing. Once you get to know the person, if there's no substance there, that privilege dies out really quickly, and vice versa. For a person who doesn't fall under pretty privilege, for them, it might be hard to initially attract someone, but if their personality and their confidence, it matches what the other person is looking for, essentially, then the physical aspect of it won't matter. So confidence and sense of character and interest is far more important, and research will show this time and time again, far more attractive and sustainable rather than physical appearance.
Interesting messages coming in on this, of course, 4001. We're saying pretty privilege, but this, of course, is relevant to men and women. Have you had preferential treatment, freebies? You know, we had Seema earlier getting off with a parking ticket for fluttering her eyelashes because of how you look. No name on this one saying, in my opinion, I'm ordinary. However, people do always tell me I'm a very good looking guy, also naturally muscly. And I've noticed now I'm older, I do get preferential treatment personally and professionally. But it's helped me to be a super confident person. And I think that's a really interesting point. If you're perhaps not naturally confident, but people respond positively to you, that's going to bolster you. That's going to encourage you. I mean, what I would say, I mean, just caveat in case my husband is listening, I obviously think my husband's incredibly attractive. But I'm not personally, I'm a bit suspicious of really good looking like model type guys because, and again, this is probably an unfair assumption. I think, well, if you're really hot, you haven't really had to work on your personality. You're probably, you know, maybe a bit lazy conversationally or in other areas. I can see you judging me through IRON Microsoft Teams.
No, actually, I'm really not. What I'm laughing at is that it's not wrong. What you're saying is not wrong. But the flip side to that is that also exists with people who don't fall under the pretty category. So the same way you have people who are pretty and not very bright, let's say, you also have people who aren't pretty who are also not very bright. But we don't make that association as much as we make the association of pretty equals not so smart.
So is there an answer to this? And I can't believe we've been talking about this for, you know, as long as we have without mentioning social media and perhaps the role that that plays. And this is really where the conversation got started. 60 million views of people looking at pretty privilege on TikTok. What role do you think the filters and the presentation, I guess, of ourselves on social media plays into this aspiration of being attractive?
I think it feeds into it so much. I mean, the reality is I'm so happy to see people that are actually starting to remove filters and show themselves and kind of do a before and after Instagram versus real life. And they're showing, and you do this a lot, Helen. I've seen you do it. I love that you do that.
Thank you.
Because the reality is that the more we show people what is real, the more likely we are to help people build their self-esteem and their confidence. But when we are, especially younger children, because this is where it's crucial for that age gap. But when we don't do that, we're really hurting this next generation because we're showing them things that they're not going to amount to, especially without a sense of fakeness to it.
Mika saying, I was fat in high school, got fit after college. The fat years made me funny. Hashtag grateful. That's the combination you want. That is, you've absolutely nailed it. Because I think, unfortunately, you have got people who might have peaked at high school and have all of that, you know, popular years and I'm used to people treating me amazing, and then the looks fade by 20 and you're left going, I'm high and dry. Develop the personality and then get hot. Mika, you've nailed the dream combination here. but didn't you know, we're talking about pretty today, but, you know, me losing weight, I've definitely noticed how people respond differently to me, and whether that is brands wanting to work with me now that I'm not weighing as much, or maybe that comes back to confidence, Thrive. Maybe that's nothing to do with my weight at all. Maybe it's just to do with feeling a bit happier in my skin now.
I think it could be a combination of both, right, Helen? Because the unfortunately, social media and marketing will usually gear all of their products towards the social standard of pretty and attractive, and that puts so many people aside. It sets them aside and it marginalizes them, because in reality, a good 90% of people don't look like social mm-hmm. media portrays, right? And so I think there is this need and this want to allow people to look at different definitions of attractiveness and so on and so forth. And confidence as well is equally important. However, usually in social media and things like, you know, any kind of ads and so on and so forth, you can't really see confidence as much as you see the person, right? So the physical aspect is usually a lot more important in those kinds of scenarios. But when we're talking about interactions with people, definitely the confidence would be far more important.
Love it. Thuraya, thank you as ever. To anyone out there experiencing pretty privilege, good for you. Enjoy it while you can. Share the love. If you get any freebies, 4001, I'm right here. Dr. Thuraya can be found at the Human Relations Institute and Clinic.
This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Join the conversation
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
And thank you for downloading this episode of the Afternoons with Helen Farmer podcast. Don't forget, you can subscribe. You'll get direct to your phone as soon as it's out. And you can listen to me live on Dubai Eye 103.8, Monday to Friday between 2 and 5 p.m.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to dubaieye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.